Chapter 19. All Present and Accounted For. Have you ever thought that people understood what you were talking about only to find they didn't get it at all? Unfortunately, it happened on board Santa Fe and almost cost us a good sailor. March 5th, 1999, San Diego, California, 116 days to deployment. We'd arrived in San Diego an hour earlier, and I was stewing over a report that showed multiple mechanical problems with our missile tubes. This was our first long underway, and we started caring about their condition. Not surprisingly, when a system that is subjected to salt water and sea pressure is neglected, switches, connectors, and pressure sensors fail. The Cobb appeared at my door. I was hoping to discuss our plan for getting the system 100% ready before the upcoming strike exercise. "Sir," he said, "fuck this shit," and left the boat. "Huh? Who?" "Oh, I thought you knew. Sled Dog went AWOL." Of course I knew him well. He was one of the junior quartermasters who had surprised me with their participation in improving our chart process. Standing quartermaster of the watch is tough business. It's important for the safe navigation of the ship, and there is little room for error. Worse, it's under constant scrutiny, because the watch is stood in the control room, while the officer of the deck directly supervises the quartermaster, the executive officer and I frequently came into the control room and headed straight for the chart to see where we were. Frequently, the quartermaster would be attempting to plot his rounds, with three or four officers crowding around the chart table. It is one of a handful of watch stations personally qualified by the captain. My initial reaction was that I just didn't need this, and I slumped down in my chair. I was already feeling bad. I had just realized that we were giving the Navy-wide advancement examinations this week. I had been preoccupied with the navigation of the submarine to San Diego and effective operations with the battle group and hadn't paid attention to the scheduling of the advancement exams. The Navy picks the dates, and everyone takes the exams on the same day to prevent compromise. Performance on these exams would largely determine whether the 100 petty officers on Santa Fe would be promoted. But because we hadn't been talking about the advancement exams and we hadn't scheduled any study time, I didn't have high hopes we had set the crew up for success. Going AWOL, absent without leave, would be a permanent mark on Sled Dog's record, further hindering his potential to get promoted. It was also a serious indictment of how things were going on board Santa Fe. After our problem with shore power and in the torpedo room, things started getting better. A junior officer withdrew his resignation, and we started seeing reenlistment requests from the enlisted men. This was a sign that morale was turning around. Sled Dog's jumping ship would be a big setback. We convened a meeting, a critique of sorts. Present were Sled Dog's chain of command, including Lieutenant Commander Bill Green and Chief John Larson, as well as the Cobb, the executive officer, and me. There were two camps. On one side, several of the senior enlisted men and chiefs pointed out that Sled Dog had been in the Navy for several years, was perfectly sober, knew what he was doing, and knew what the consequences of his actions were. He was on his own, and they already had a report sheet written up on him that would send him to captain's mast. It would be important for good order and discipline to deal with him harshly, especially with deployment looming. We didn't want sailors thinking they could renege on their obligation to the nation and their shipmates. On the other side, the officers were more sympathetic. They pointed out that the quartermasters had been standing port and starboard watch since we left Pearl Harbor a week ago. That meant Sled Dog had stood watch 6 hours on, 6 hours off. Of course, you have to eat, prepare for watch, and conduct post-watch duties during those 6 hours off. So it ends up being more like 8 hours on, 4 hours off. Then there are training sessions, certifications, and all-hands drills. If they occurred during your sleep time, too bad. In this case, we had had piloting certifications, run drills, and shifted the clocks 2 hours ahead to match the local San Diego time. All of these factors had, unfortunately, conspired to reduce Sled Dog's sleep in the previous 36 hours to zero. No one planned it, but no one was looking out for him either. We then had several hours piloting the ship into San Diego. This is a period of intense activity while we bring the ship into port, especially for the quartermasters. While Sled Dog wasn't going to win awards as the top-ranking petty officer in his division, he was a hard worker and a valuable member of the watch team. If we lost him, Santa Fe would be unable to get underway. If we were already port and starboard, then we'd be down to port and report, which meant that we had only one qualified watchstander for the quartermaster watch station. This would be a severe limitation to the ship's ability to act in the nation's defense. The tip of the iceberg? I decided to dig deeper into the problem. Question: why were the quartermasters port and starboard anyway? Answer: because there weren't enough of them to support the normal three-section watch bill. Question: why not? Answer: the chief of that division hadn't gotten enough of his guys qualified. We'd had a perilously shallow bench. The qualification was broken. Question: was anyone else qualified who could have made them three-section instead of port and starboard? Answer: yes. The leading first-class petty officer of that division, a supervisor, but he was off the watch bill in order to be ready to stand the discretionary watch, navigation supervisor. Question: but isn't the navigation supervisor stationed to increase safety of the navigation picture when the ship is close to land? Answer: yes. Question: and didn't we just cross the Eastern Pacific Ocean from Hawaii to San Diego? Answer: yes. Question: and did we need a navigation supervisor? Answer: no. This pissed me off. This supervisor was letting his guys go without sleep, and he wasn't even on the watch bill. I reviewed the entire watch bill more carefully and realized that the diving officer of the watch, a watch stood by the chiefs, was 1 in 6. In other words, they shared one watch station among 6 qualified chiefs, 1 6-hour watch every 36 hours. Meantime, the standard crew rotation was 1 in 3, 3 men per watch station, and some watch stations, like Sled Dog's, was 1 in 2, 2 men for the one watch station. How did that happen? It was the normal way of doing business on submarines. Some boats take their chiefs entirely off the watch bill. That this could be viewed as an acceptable way of doing business was a manifestation of the idea that being a chief meant you had more privileges, not more responsibility. It was the good life that the junior enlisted were supposed to aspire to. But it had the opposite effect. All it did was alienate the crew. I was upset that the chiefs had taken care of themselves first, and the crew was paying for it. "Where is Sled Dog now?" I asked. No one was sure, but he was seen heading toward the barracks, the on-base housing for the crew. I thought about that. Why would someone go to the on-base barracks if they wanted to go AWOL? And thinking about what Sled Dog had been through, I'm pretty sure I would have said fuck this shit as well. By this point, I was firmly in the sympathetic camp, but I was having trouble convincing the chiefs that we had an obligation to try and find him. I could have ordered it, but that would have resulted in forced compliance. I decided to find him myself. I departed the ship and headed over to the enlisted barracks a couple blocks from where we were moored at Submarine Base San Diego on Point Loma. I found the barracks manager, and amazingly, Sled Dog had registered and had a room. Strange behavior if he was quitting the Navy. I went to his room and knocked. He was there. I needed to be careful because I didn't want to say anything that exonerated his behavior or manifested my displeasure with the chiefs. At the same time, I was sympathetic to his lack of sleep and the uneven treatment he'd received. I had the report sheet written up on him in my hand. Going AWOL carries steep penalties. He could be restricted to the ship for 60 days, which would keep him on the ship for a major part of the import time prior to deployment. He could lose a month's pay, and he could get busted down a rank. We had a conversation. I could see he was emotionally and physically exhausted. In a dramatic move, I tore up the report chit and granted him amnesty, but made it clear he needed to be back on the ship the following morning. He probably didn't know it, but I had tainted any potential captain's mast I might hold on him by getting personally involved. If it ever went to a court-martial, a lawyer would have a field day. I was betting we would never need to go that far. I went back to Santa Fe and mustered the chiefs. I reviewed what we'd been through and reminded them of the January meeting we'd had in the old periscope shop in Pearl Harbor. I was upset because it seemed like in some cases they'd taken the increased authority I'd given them and used that to make their own situations easier. Some were missing the sense of obligation toward their men. Weren't we all in a meeting together back in January when you accepted responsibility for your men and for running the ship? Didn't we all understand that that meant being involved, participating, sharing the pain with the crew, not acting like some privileged aristocracy? I was barking out these words and gesturing toward them with my flashlight. I was pissed. Well, yes. I told the chiefs about the deal I made with Sled Dog. Some thought I was setting a bad precedent. Had they been dishonest in January? I don't think so. I just don't think they could picture how much different it would be if they started walking the talk. No wonder the crew was demoralized with this kind of behavior going on. No wonder Santa Fe had reenlisted merely 3 guys the entire previous year. I had an overwhelming urge to take all authority away from the chiefs, to take local and immediate control, to get them on board. This, of course, would have been entirely expected and made me like every other leader. The next morning, the Cobb came in with his daily muster report. Captain, all present and accounted for. He turned and departed. We both knew that meant Sled Dog had returned as promised. Not all the chiefs were happy with the resolution of the Sled Dog issue. Some worried that I had set a bad standard and that there would be an erosion of military discipline. They feared a host of AWOLs, and if I held those sailors accountable, it would be hypocritical. It was suggested there would be an appearance of favoritism, maybe even a perception that I'd shown deference in the case of a minority. Turns out, their predictions were wrong. We never had another AWOL in 3 years. I resisted taking more control and continued to let the Cobb and executive officer manage the enlisted watch bill. After I got over my anger, I invoked the following rule of watch bill equitability. No supervisory watch station could be in a watch rotation better than the worst rotation of any watch station reporting to that supervisor. As this would work its way up the chain, there would be no way the chiefs or officers would be better off than the crew. This wasn't taken well, but I needed to get the point across, and I was tired of trying to explain things in a non-coercive way. They would just have to experience it. Mechanism: continually and consistently repeat the message. The issue I had the hardest time coming to grips with was how I didn't know all this was happening. Technically, the executive officer signs the enlisted watch bill, so technically I wasn't responsible. Still, I was. I had been in the control room 100 times during the previous week. I'd frequently seen Sled Dog standing there on watch. Sure, I had excuses. I was focused on other things, whereas managing the watch bill was the direct responsibility of others. No matter how I rationalized it, however, I felt responsible. Perhaps this sense of responsibility colored my actions, and perhaps it could have come out badly. Had I carefully weighed the potential impact to me personally, I would never have gone in body to the enlisted barracks. I didn't think like that, though. I was only worried about my sailor, who was off by himself and dealing with senior management that wasn't trying to get him on board. Again, I resigned myself to the fact that my new approach to leadership wasn't working. It was too hard, and if the chiefs didn't get it, how could we be successful? I considered going back to barking orders and demanding rigid compliance. Upon reflection, that wasn't the leader I wanted to be, and I was convinced that my original course was right. Giving people authority paired with responsibility and the tools to do the job would pay off in the end. I resisted this urge and decided we needed to stay the course. The behavior of the chiefs was totally baffling to me. After 2 months under my command, how could they not get what we were trying to do? I'd given them much greater authority with chiefs in charge. They'd helped write the guiding principles. They'd heard me talk 100 times about how we were going to run things on Santa Fe. It seemed as if there were some evil force that was pushing against us and kept people in the same old way of thinking. What I realized, however, is the need for a relentless, consistent repetition of the message. Continually and consistently repeat the message is a mechanism for competence. Repeat the same message day after day, meeting after meeting, event after event. Sounds redundant, repetitive, and boring, but what's the alternative? Changing the message? That results in confusion and a lack of direction. I didn't realize the degree to which old habits die hard, even when people are emotionally on board with the change. The chiefs wanted to be on board, but they pictured a leadership approach, a style they'd seen before on the USS Eustafish, the generic term for the submarine I used to be on. They just pictured something from their past. It was hard for them to create an image of what we were trying to accomplish. It was something brand new. There wasn't an existing example or movie we could point to. When you bring in something new, something that has never been seen before, you can talk about it and some will get it. On Santa Fe, we did have some chiefs who got it immediately. Senior Chief Warshak got it. Chief Larson got it. Some would get it soon. Others would take longer. I discovered that what happens when you explain a change is that the crew hears what you say, but they are thinking, oh yeah, I know what he's talking about. That's like how it was on the Eustafish. They hear and think they know what you mean, but they don't. They've never had a picture of what you are talking about. They can't see in their imagination how it works. They are not being intentionally deceitful. They are just not picturing what you are picturing. Moreover, if they understand what you mean, they might be skeptical that this new way of doing business, which is different from anything they've seen before, could be better. How is it possible to be in the Navy for, fill in the number of years, and not have seen this? In order to help me remember this and keep my cool, I had a poster made. I got the idea from an article titled, It's a Dog Life, which I'd read in the November 1995 issue of Fast Company. It profiled Verifone's then CEO, Hatim Tayabi. In the poster, I'm standing in front of my dog Barclay, saying, sit. The dog was standing. The first 8 frames were identical, sit, 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 etc. No recriminations, no admonishments, just sit. In the 9th and last frame, Barclay is sitting, and the caption is, good dog. I hung this on the back of my stateroom door. Since my door was open most of the time, visitors didn't see it, but I would. Questions to consider. Are any of your employees on the brink of going AWOL because they're overworked and underappreciated? When is it right for the leader to overturn protocol in the effort to rescue a single stressed-out subordinate? What messages do you need to keep repeating in your business to make sure your management team doesn't take care of themselves first to the neglect of their teams? Chapter 20, Final Preparations. Do you believe that allowing initiative from the bottom won't work in a crisis? I learned that even in casualties, emergencies, releasing control yields better results. May 1999, underway from Pearl Harbor to San Diego, 28 days to deployment. At sea again, Santa Fe was heading back to San Diego. We needed this time to run a complete set of drills and hone our operational skills. Our final certification for deployment, POM Cert, would happen once we got to San Diego. While it was coming faster than I would have liked, there was a lot going right on Santa Fe. Our sailors were submitting reenlistment requests, and maintenance was going well for the first time. Watch officers were solving problems, and department heads were talking to each other. Deliberate action was reducing errors, and more of the crew were becoming believers. The chiefs continued to grow into their chiefs-in-charge authority. What started with managing leave chits had now grown into controlling schedules and managing qualifications. We had gotten through the backlog of crew members awaiting tests and interviews for qualifications, and the average time to qualify in submarines was steadily marching down. Now, when I arrived on board in the morning, the ship was already a beehive of activity as opposed to a bunch of guys waiting for permission. Still, I wasn't certain that we would be ready for deployment. The past 6 weeks had been ones of frenetic activity and tension. After returning to Pearl Harbor, the submarine went into a maintenance period, our last opportunity for 9 months to do major maintenance. I had a long list of equipment worries, including sonar equipment, the oxygen generator, missile and torpedo tubes, and updates to the electronics and software for the combat control system, to name a few. Additionally, although we would perform many daily, weekly, and monthly maintenance routines while on deployment to keep our equipment in peak condition, the less frequent routine maintenance would need to be done now. Somehow, the crew had gotten it all done, and we had gotten underway. We always had the goal of performing training during these maintenance periods, but it rarely happened. Now we had a week to make it all up. There was no going back on our management experiment now. We were going to sink or swim with our new approach. Fire, fire, fire! A fire on a submarine is one of the most life-threatening accidents we could have. Not only would thick black smoke force us to wear our emergency air breathing devices, the visibility would be reduced to near zero. Unchecked, the fire would grow in size, and the contained atmosphere in the boat would result in heat and pressure increases that would make human existence impossible. 11 years previously, in April 1988, a fire aboard the USS Bonefish killed 3 sailors. In that fire, the heat got so intense that the shoes of the crew members standing on the deck above the fire melted. The key time was 2 minutes. Studies showed we needed a fire hose applying water to the fire within 2 minutes. I was standing just forward of the crew's mess, which was full of nukes and training, when the fire alarm rang. The department heads ran the drill programs, but I approved all the drills, including when and how they would start. The engineer had briefed the drill monitors that the fire would be in the storeroom just aft of the crew's mess. I wanted to see what would happen because I had been previously frustrated that it took too long to get immediate extinguishing agents and fire hoses to the fire. The closest fire hose on Santa Fe was in the passageway just forward of the crew's mess, about 50 feet from the fire's location. It should have been easy. The entire engineering department, 40 people, was conducting training in the crew's mess. The fire was detected and the alarm was sounded. What happened next? Well, the nukes scattered, running right by the hose and leaving it hanging on the bulkhead. The crew members assigned to that particular hose couldn't even get to the hose because there were so many nukes in the way. Why didn't the nukes just take up the hose, lay it out, pressurize it, and end the whole thing in 60 seconds? Because the submarine force hadn't trained them to do that, following standard procedure that the Navy had encouraged as a best practice, we had determined that watchstanders on duty would man the hoses. This was originally decided because in the event of a fire at 0300, we couldn't count on enough crew members to be up and about to self-organize into an effective response. So we identified watchstanders as contingency firefighters who would leave their watch stations and deal with a fire. This was an exception to the normal practice. Leaving your watch station unattended was not allowed. Over the next few years, as ships were evaluated by various inspection teams, the inspectors would stand there with a clipboard and ask the nozzleman, when he showed up, who he was. "I'm the on-watch auxiliaryman forward." The inspector would look at the watch bill and make sure he was the one identified. If not, it would be a deficiency, a watch bill violation. This was another example of where the procedure had become the master and not the servant. The motivation had shifted from putting the fire out to following the procedure. As a result, we got the crazy behavior observed on the mess deck of the Santa Fe. Yet another problem was underlying and distorting the crew's behavior. There was no incentive for the crew to put the simulated fire out early. Drill guides at the time foretold a prescriptive set of events. They weren't connected in any way to the crew's response. For instance, if the crew immediately brought a portable extinguisher, the fire would grow. Even if the crew arrived with a pressurized fire hose in less than 2 minutes and applied water to the base of the fire, using appropriate firefighting techniques, wearing the right equipment and hard-soled shoes, the fire would spread more. It would require multiple hoses and a sustained attack to douse the fire. The submarine would fill with smoke, and we would need to go to periscope depth and ventilate. It was a one-hour drill. The thinking behind the guides was that the crew needed to be drilled on and prepared for all possible outcomes. We changed all that. Mechanism: specify goals, not methods. First, we attacked the motivation problem. We authorized the drill monitor at the scene to adapt the drill based on the crew's response. If the crew applied a portable extinguisher in the first 45 seconds, the fire was out. Done! If it took 2 minutes to get a pressurized hose to the scene, the fire was out. Done! These consequences modeled nature. Now the crew was motivated to actually do what we wanted them to do, attack the fire with portable fire extinguishers and pressurized fire hoses, unencumbered by administrative disincentives and distractions. Next, I explained to the crew that our objective was to put the fire out, and I didn't care who was on the hose. They responded, and we significantly improved our response time. Now, when the alarm sounded, the closest men self-organized to achieve the goal. We would later receive awards for our damage control responses. We also revamped another aspect of responding to casualties, like fires. The force-wide practice was to use terse commands when responding to casualties. For example, during a fire, the man at the scene must verbally paint a picture of what he is seeing. We didn't have a set of video cameras monitoring the spaces. As a result, the commanding officer in control, or others around the ship, would not know how extensive the fire was. And our limited language got in the way. All we had was the word fire to cover the spectrum from a wall of flames to a smoking dryer lint trap. Our practice was to use the standard word, but then we started adding context, such as whether there were open flames or not. This mechanism of describing what you see is an extension of thinking out loud. The officers who manned Damage Control Central, or DC Central, controlled the ship's response to casualties. DC Central consisted of a department head set up in my stateroom with charts and status boards and phone talkers. We started to explain to the crew that the casualty drill going forward would be different. We figured, why not just tell them what needed to happen? After all, in the case of a real casualty, this is exactly what I'd want them to do. So, in clear, concise sentences, we'd tell them, crew members in the vicinity should attack the fire with portable extinguishers. And DC Central would announce things like, a thermal imager is needed in the auxiliary room. DC Central would not specify who or how. The crew figured it out. The man with the thermal imager would head to the auxiliary room and, as he passed the phone talker, report, Senior Chief Warshak with the thermal imager proceeding to the auxiliary room. Again, this was thinking out loud. We found this decentralized approach to DC Central to be much more effective. We turned other practices on their head as well, such as the important practice of keeping the ship quiet. Stealth is life for a submarine, and minimizing unnecessary bangs and noises is the lifeblood of every submarine. I was standing in the control room one evening, and my sonar chief, Senior Chief Warshak, announced from the sonar room, loud transient, own ship. A transient was a temporary noise from within Santa Fe. It could be caused by any number of things, from carelessly dropping a wrench on the deck plates in the engine room to opening an air valve too quickly. This wasn't uncommon. Sonar would continuously monitor Santa Fe and announce these sound violations. At this point, the standard practice would be for the chief of the watch to call every watchstander on the ship and find out what they were all doing, so that we could determine the source of the transient. It was top-down management. But this time, Senior Chief Warshak walked into the control room and suggested we change the practice. Instead of us, in the control room, hunting down the violation, we told the watchstanders that if they made a transient, they should just call the chief of the watch and report it without being prompted. This would save a lot of time, and it turned the handling of this issue of the stealth of the submarine from a top-down approach, "We will force you to be stealthy, by God," to one where everyone felt an obligation to maintain the stealth of the ship. We tried it. Not everyone was sure this would work. First of all, it was different. Old-timers grumbled that we'd lose our acoustic superiority if we let the crew make whatever noise they wanted to, so long as they just confessed. Once again, however, it didn't turn out that way. We started getting many more reports of transients than those detected by sonar. No one yelled, no one criticized. We just analyzed when, why, and how the noisy events occurred. There were things like pressurizing tanks, shifting valves under pressure, using hydraulics, or shifting steam and lube oil system lineups. Many occurred back in the engine room, and because the main sonar was in the bow, they would go undetected. By unemotionally addressing all the transients that occurred, rather than only the ones that our monitoring systems detected, we ended up with a quieter ship. We arrived in San Diego to pick up the inspectors. The night before the inspection, I found that I was quite serene internally about this major test of my leadership ability and the crew. Normally, the vulnerability of being responsible for the performance of the ship, yet delegating almost all of the control, would have left me anxious. I attributed my peace to my attitude of learning and curiosity. My confidence was justified. The crew performed superbly, and Commodore Mark Kenny certified us for deployment. I was happy to see a large portion of the crew using the three-name rule. Our reputation was riding high. All we needed to do now was to return to Pearl Harbor, execute a couple weeks of final preparations and loadouts, and we'd be underway for deployment on June 18th, ready to go 2 weeks early. Specifying to the crew that the true objective was to put the fire out as quickly as possible was a mechanism primarily for competence. Specifying goals, not methods, is a mechanism for competence. In our case, this was because the crew was motivated to devise the best approach to putting out the fire. Once they were freed from following a prescribed way of doing things, they came up with many ingenious ways to shave seconds off our response time. As an example, we had always berthed the crew strictly according to rank. They realized that certain damage control equipment was easier to get to from some bunks than others. By rearranging the berthing plan and assigning those bunks to the men who had responsibility for the nearby damage control equipment, they were able to respond faster. In a way, specifying goals also served as a mechanism for clarity by focusing on achieving excellence rather than avoiding errors. We found over and over again on Santa Fe that compliance with the procedures had supplanted accomplishing the objective as the ultimate goal. Although we don't want people to founder, and we want adherence to procedures and best practices, we nevertheless should be on guard against this tendency. The problem with specifying the method along with the goal is one of diminished control. Provide your people with the objective and let them figure out the method. Questions to consider. Have your processes become the master rather than the servant? How can you ensure adherence to procedure while at the same time ensuring that accomplishing the objective remains foremost in everyone's mind? Have you reviewed your operations manual lately to replace general terminology with clear, concise, specific directions? Are your staff complying with procedures to the neglect of accomplishing the company's overall objectives? Part 4. Clarity. As more decision-making authority is pushed down the chain of command, it becomes increasingly important that everyone throughout the organization understands what the organization is about. This is called clarity, and it is the second supporting leg, along with competence, that is needed in order to distribute control. Clarity means people at all levels of an organization clearly and completely understand what the organization is about. This is needed because people in the organization make decisions against a set of criteria that includes what the organization is trying to accomplish. If clarity of purpose is misunderstood, then the criteria by which a decision is made will be skewed, and suboptimal decisions will be made. The chapters in this part will introduce you to the mechanisms we devised to implement leader-leader practices by stressing clarity. The mechanisms described are these. Achieve excellence. Don't just avoid errors. This was introduced in Chapter 7. Build trust and take care of your people. Use your legacy for inspiration. Use guiding principles for decision criteria. Use immediate recognition to reinforce desired behaviors. Begin with the end in mind. Encourage a questioning attitude over blind obedience. Chapter 21, Underway for Deployment. How can you take care of your people? Turns out there are lots of ways. June 18th, 1999, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Deployed. We'd done it. I'd been in command of Santa Fe for 161 days, and we were ready to deploy 2 weeks early. Everything was ready for our deployment. Stores loaded, weapons loaded and checked, all personnel on board, reactor operating, and main engines warmed up. The tug was tied alongside, ready to pull Santa Fe away from the pier and back us into the channel. At that point, we would cast off from the tug and head out the main shipping channel toward the Pacific Ocean. No inspectors, no riders, no strap hangers. Just 135 highly empowered sailors eager to serve their country. Santa Fe would head west from Pearl Harbor and make a stop in Japan. For several weeks thereafter, we would operate in the western Pacific before transiting the Strait of Malacca between Singapore and Indonesia into the Indian Ocean and then cross to the Middle East. We'd then operate in and around the Arabian Sea for a couple of months before returning to Pearl Harbor. Altogether, we'd be gone for 6 months. On the pier, a large group of wives and children and other family members stood together. As we cast off the lines and tossed them to the pier, we sounded one prolonged blast from the whistle. Most of the family members looked up at the bridge. In that moment, I realized exactly what my job was. I was to take these 134 men under my command, thousands of miles from home, potentially engaging in combat, and bring them back safely to all those upturned faces. It gave me a renewed sense of purpose. The transit out the channel went quickly, and we soon submerged and headed west. I gathered the chiefs and officers, and we discussed what we wanted to accomplish. "Look, we're going to be gone for 6 months," Lieutenant Commander Rick Panlilio advocated. "We should encourage each person in the crew to establish personal goals. Take courses, read books, exercise, that kind of thing, in addition to the goals we have for Santa Fe." I agreed and was impressed that after everything we'd gone to get ready for deployment, he didn't just want to take a long nap. Rick was right. I asked around to get a pulse of the crew on this idea. Chief David Steele was enthusiastic. He wanted to start taking courses toward a college degree. The Navy has a program for that, but most people don't have the time or the initiative to take advantage of it. We decided to let the chiefs talk to their sailors about their individual goals, but we'd define some shipwide goals for everyone to focus on during the deployment. We came up with three themes: empowerment, efficiency, and tactical excellence. When we were done, we discussed whether or not we should tell people off the ship about our intentions. I thought, why not? It seemed to me that writing down our three shipwide goals in an outgoing message would add clarity to our thinking, keep my bosses informed about what we were doing, and add weight to our initiatives. Here's the message we transmitted to our superiors on June 21st, a little before crossing the international dateline. I deliberately sent it to as broad an audience as possible. From USS Santa Fe, subject, Santa Fe Deployment Objectives. Remarks. 1. Santa Fe Express is now headed west. My officers and crew are looking forward to the challenges and opportunity of being deployed on the front lines for our nation's security. 2. Working with my department heads and senior advisors, I have set empowerment, efficiency, and tactical excellence as the guiding themes for continuously improving our performance during deployment. Empowerment. I intend to empower the crew to achieve their personal and professional goals through initiatives such as a focused effort to improve advancement exam performance, encouraging PACE, program for afloat college education, and other independent study programs, and providing incentives for increased physical conditioning. I further intend to push authority and responsibility downward whenever practical to improve job satisfaction. This is a continuation of a theme I have already started to work on, and I think we are having some success. I already have 10 crewmen who have submitted reenlistment requests for the Gulf. Reenlistment in the Arabian Gulf carries tax benefits. Efficiency. Reaching our empowerment goals will require us to significantly improve crew efficiency. We will strive for greater efficiency in everything from running tighter drill scenarios to removing inefficiencies in meal preparation and service. Tactical excellence. I intend to continue our pursuit of tactical excellence by encouraging innovative methods of leveraging Santa Fe's combat power, with particular emphasis on submarine support to the battle group, national tasking, strike warfare, and special operations. 3. I am working to establish measures of effectiveness for each of our goals. I will keep you posted on our progress toward empowerment, efficiency, and tactical excellence. Very respectfully, Commander David Marquet. Mechanism: build trust and take care of your people. During the first few days out of port, I spent a fair amount of time walking about the ship. Reed received some bad news. The promotion announcements were in based on the advancement examination, and we hadn't done well. I knew this was tough on the men after all the work they had done getting Santa Fe ready for deployment, and after leaving their families for 6 months. I wanted to get a sense of just how much that disappointment was affecting the crew. The more I saw and heard, the more I became aware that we'd done a great disservice to our crew back in March regarding the advancement exams. I vowed to do something about it, but one thing that continued to trouble me was why I had to drive this from the top. Couldn't we get the chiefs themselves involved in their own guys' advancement prospects? After all, as chiefs, they had somehow figured out how to get advanced. That's why they were chiefs. I kept this gripe to myself and focused on understanding the problem. The first issue was that our crew, by which I mean the enlisted men who are not yet chiefs and made up 80% of the ship's company, did not thoroughly understand how the advancement system worked. The crew had heard so many myths and had been given so much misinformation. They had come to believe that the advancement system was a mystical process over which they had no control. It was this issue of control that we had to attack first. The process worked like this. All petty officers received a composite advancement score after taking the exam to determine if they would be advanced. This composite score was made up of a weighting of the following marks: a score for their performance evaluation marks, a score for their grade on the Navy-wide advancement examination, and scores for awards, time in Navy, time and rate, and the number of times they'd previously taken the exam but had not been advanced. Roughly a third of the final composite was based on the performance evaluation marks, a third was based on the examination, and a third was based on the remaining components. Not everyone who is eligible gets promoted. The higher positions are scarce. There are several reasons why promotions are not unlimited. First, the number of jobs gets smaller as the ranks get higher. This pyramid is a deliberate personnel planning mechanism for the Navy. Even if the Navy wanted to promote everyone eligible, they can't because Congress appropriates money for the Navy's personnel programs and pay, and hence sets a cap on how many people the Navy can have at each rank level. The Naval Personnel Command would then determine the cutoff score based on how many total openings we had for the next higher rank. Sailors below that level were PNA, passed, not advanced. This meant that they'd passed the exam, but did not achieve a final multiple high enough for advancement. Fortunately, the Navy provides each command with detailed results for each person who took the test. In the past, we'd always handed these sheets to the sailors and let them deal with it on an individual basis. This time, I made a copy of all the results and performed some mathematical analysis on the aggregate population. I had spreadsheets of the data. I spent hours sorting, correlating, and graphing the data. The analysis showed that even though the exam made up about 33% of the total score, it accounted for more than 80% of the variation in points between those who were advanced and those who were not. In all the other components that made up the final multiple, performance marks as well as awards, time in the Navy, and time and rate, etc., the candidates were tightly grouped, and the difference between those advanced and those not advanced was small. The exam, therefore, made all the difference. Our guys had averaged 51 points on the exam, whereas the average sailor who was advanced averaged 64. Guys who were losing 10 to 20 points on the exam couldn't make it up with a couple of extra awards. You'd need 10 Navy Achievement Medals to do that. Ironically, this was great news, because examination performance was something we could control. My overwhelming theme for the men would be, you can get advanced and we can help you. We went to work fixing this. Next, we looked at the areas in which our petty officers did poorly. Again, the detailed reports the Navy provided had the detailed data, but they needed to be analyzed in an aggregated manner. The yeoman did poorly on travel administration. Well, arranging travel wasn't something you did as a yeoman assigned to a submarine, so we augmented that topic with training. The auxiliary men did poorly on fuels. On a conventional ship, the management of fuels is a key activity, but not so much on a nuclear submarine, so we needed additional training there. We decided to give practice examinations. As the petty officers were studying for the next exam cycle, we asked them to write down sample multiple-choice questions based on what they were reading. In addition to shifting their study habits from passive reading to actively thinking about test questions, we began to generate our own internal advancement exam, sprinkling these multiple-choice questions into our continuing training program. These did not entirely replace, but rather augmented the short-answer questions we normally tested on. We also made our questions harder than the ones on the actual advancement examination. For example, our multiple-choice questions could have none, one, or more than one right answer. This required significantly more in-depth knowledge and helped build on the technical competence of the crew. Prior to the September advancement exam, the dates are Navy-wide, in March and September, we gave full practice advancement exams. Rather than looking at the advancement process as a separate activity, we integrated it into the operations of the submarine. Now, all our interests were aligned. Taking care of your people extends beyond their work lives. Our first stop after transiting the Western Pacific would be Okinawa, Japan. Okinawa is in the middle of the Ryukyu Island chain, which stretches in an arc from the southern tip of the main island group of Japan to Taiwan, 600 miles away. Okinawa was the scene of a major battle in World War II between April and June, 1945. Currently, it is the home of a U.S. Marine Corps base. As we approached Okinawa, two things became apparent. First, the executive officer who was on Santa Fe when I arrived would be transferring to spend time with his father, who was ill. Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley, his replacement, would have to be transferred aboard and would now be the executive officer for the deployment. This was an unusual personnel transfer because Tom was coming from a staff job in Pearl Harbor, had not attended the prospective executive officer course, and hadn't spent any time during the workup with the ship. I needed to justify this highly unusual move. The argument we made went like this. Where would he learn more, on deployment on an operational submarine, or back in the classroom in New London? The answer, of course, was on the submarine. The question we had neither asked nor answered, however, was how would the submarine cope with an executive officer who needed training from day one. The second decision had to do with my engineer, Rick Panlilio. Rick's wife was pregnant and would likely have their baby in the next couple of weeks. I sorely wanted to transfer Rick off in Okinawa. It's hard enough to justify transferring the engineer at any time during deployment, but with the simultaneous transfer of the executive officer, I thought it was going to be a tough sell. Still, I had missed my daughter's birth in 1989 because my command, the Will Rogers again, wouldn't let me go in time. I wanted to fix past wrongs. I gathered the leadership team and we discussed it. I wasn't sure how to convince our operational boss to approve the plan. All communication would have to go through standard Navy message traffic. No face-to-face, no video, no phone call. Like so many times, my not knowing the answer ahead of time helped me. Instead of a scripted meeting where I pretended to solicit ideas, we had an honest conversation. At the end, we thought that if we presented a well-thought-out plan to Rear Admiral Joseph Kroll, who, as commander, Submarine Group 7 in Japan, was our operational commander, it would be approved. Lieutenant Commander Bill Green went off to draft the message we would send. In the end, it looked like this. From USS Santa Fe to Subgroup 7, subject, personnel transfer. 1. Admiral, my engineer's wife is due to have their baby any moment now, although sending two of the ship's most senior officers, the executive officer and engineer, off just prior to transit would be imprudent for most ships. My wardroom is so rife with talented junior officers that it affords me the opportunity to do this. Lieutenant Brooks will be acting engineer, and as I have stated, he is a superb naval officer. Additionally, I have two top-notch navigation supervisors in addition to the nav. The engineer is a dedicated professional and is not pushing for this. However, I know he would be disappointed not to be there, and I feel I can safely put him on leave. It worked. The plan was approved. This was possible only because the ship had demonstrated superior skills, and through our implementation of the leader-leader structure, we had developed an extensive pool of talent. Here is where it all paid off. One officer was with his father at a critical time, and another officer was there for his child's birth. Rick got there in time. Our efforts to improve the petty officer's performance on the advancement exams were rewarded as well. Months later, the Cobb walked in with a smile. He handed me the advancement results. I scanned down the sheet and was happy to see that YN2's Scott Dillon was now YN1's Scott Dillon. His next step would be to compete for chief. We had done significantly better than the previous year. Overall, in 1999, we advanced 48 enlisted men, 40% of the enlisted crew. By explaining the process to the crew and giving them the tools to improve their performance, we empowered them to determine their own success. We would do even better in 2000 and 2001. There were not a lot of things I could do for the crew to get them more money other than ensuring that they had the best opportunity for advancement. I worked hard on that. Because the crew was convinced that I was on their team, there was never any issues with negative responses to constructive criticism. It was never a me versus you issue. Had they not believed I was doing everything I could for them, it would have been a lot tougher when I asked them to work so hard. Building trust and taking care of your people is a mechanism for clarity. I worked hard to overcome my natural intolerance of inadequacies and my blunt speaking, but I didn't always succeed. I found over time that when I blurted out criticism, people didn't mind. They didn't take it personally because they knew that 2 weeks previously I had been doing everything possible to get them promoted. It's hard to find a leadership book that doesn't encourage us to take care of our people. What I learned is this. Taking care of your people does not mean protecting them from the consequences of their own behavior. That's the path to irresponsibility. What it does mean is giving them every available tool and advantage to achieve their aims in life beyond the specifics of the job. In some cases, that meant further education. In other cases, crewmen's goals were incompatible with Navy life, and they separated on good terms. Questions to consider. What would you and your team like to accomplish? How can you as a leader help your people accomplish it? Are you doing everything you can to make tools available to your employees to achieve both professional and personal goals? Are you unintentionally protecting people from the consequences of their own behavior? Chapter 22, A Remembrance of War. Do you have a rich organizational legacy? We did, but we weren't using it. July 2, 1999, Western Pacific Ocean, in command. 580 feet, 23 down, 18 knots. Santa Fe was pitching rapidly toward the ocean bottom. Just because we were certified and deployed didn't mean we stopped running casualty drills. This was a jam dive from high speed. It simulates a failure of the stern planes in the maximum downward position. At high speeds, it is a dangerous condition because the submarine rapidly pitches downward. We had taken the appropriate immediate actions, all-back emergency, full rise on the bow planes, emergency blowing the forward ballast tanks. 600 feet, 25 down, 14 knots, 610 feet, 26 down, 12 knots. Still going down, but at a slower rate. The diving officer of the watch was calling out the depth, down angle, and speed so everyone in the control room would know it. He sat just behind the planesman and had the clearest sight of the panel indicating what was happening with ship control. He slowed down his voice as the rate of change slowed. Now that the immediate actions had been taken, he was waiting for the officer of the deck to order supplemental actions. Now, I thought. The downward pitch had essentially been arrested, the speed was coming off smartly, and the downward depth rate was minimal. Now was the time to vent the forward ballast tanks and go all stop on the main engines. If the backing bell were left on too long, the ship would actually start going backward through the water, which was undesirable. The officer of the deck was looking around nervously. This wasn't a good sign. During casualties, I would watch the eyes of the watch officer. If they went down, bad. If they went to a written procedure, bad. If they looked unfocused, bad. If they were focused on the indications that would provide the necessary information for him to make the next decision, good. Inexperienced officers almost always waited too long right at this point in the emergency. They wanted to see an upward depth rate before venting. By that time, it would be too late. The expanding air would create more and more positive buoyancy forward that couldn't be vented out fast enough, and we'd be pitching up at a steep angle, still out of control. If the officer of the deck didn't order the venting within the next few seconds, the drill monitor would step in and the drill would be a failure. I was sorely tempted to shine my flashlight on the vent switches to help out, but resisted. The chief of the watch, YN1 Scott Dillon, placed his hand on the forward vent switch. The officer of the deck noticed the movement. Chief of the watch, vent the forward group. Helm, all stop. Vent the forward group, all stop. Forward vents open. Maneuvering answers, all stop. Yes, that was it. Perfect. The ship slowed to a near hover and leveled out. The chief of the watch's actions to point to the vent switch. The next key action was critical to this success. I asked Dillon, why did you do that? Well, he explained, he knew it was the next action to take, and with deliberate action, he wanted to be ready for the order. Yes, and at the same time he signaled to the officer of the deck, in a tense time, without injecting more words, what the officer of the deck needed to order. In this way, we learned another powerful aspect of deliberate action. Think about it as anticipatory deliberate action. With the movements of watchstanders indicating the next action they anticipate taking, they signal fellow team members and supervisors what they should be thinking about. It was powerful and helpful. Thereafter, whenever we talked about deliberate action, we talked about multiple benefits. Not only did it minimize the chance of a mistake by a person by himself and provide an opportunity for drill team intervention, it was also a critical aspect of teamwork. It worked in a couple ways. It was a bottom-up way of signaling action. It also worked because adjacent watchstanders could correct potential mistakes before they happened. This was an excellent example of putting our mechanism of deliberate action into practice. Mechanism: use your legacy for inspiration. After recovering from the drill, Santa Fe continued transiting toward the South China Sea. We were being vectored toward the Arabian Gulf through the Strait of Malacca. I headed back to the engine room to work out on the exercise bike. After all, I had my own personal goals like everyone else. A few minutes later, I heard, "Attention to port!" It was the officer of the deck, Lieutenant Dave Adams, on the 1MC. That was highly unusual. I'd never heard "attention to port," "starboard," or anything on the 1MC before. I got off the bike. "We are now passing the approximate location of where the USS Grayling was sunk in September 1943. A few moments later, "Carry on." Wow, what a great idea. Grayling was one of the 52 American submarines that were sunk in World War II. As we operated in the Western Pacific, we would occasionally chance past the location of one of those lost submarines. Some of the locations were known precisely, but in some cases, like the Grayling, the exact date and location remain a mystery. What we do know is that Grayling delivered supplies to guerrilla fighters at Pandan Bay, Panay, on the west coast of the Philippines on August 23, 1943. After that, it departed to hunt for Japanese merchant ships off Manila. The Navy estimated the time and location of its sinking based on post-war Japanese records and radio communications. As submariners, we have a tremendous legacy, but no formal program for inspiring a crew with that legacy. On board Santa Fe, we adopted several practices that would connect us to this rich legacy and educate the new members of the crew about what the submarine force had accomplished during World War II. We'd post notes in the plan of the day and read Medal of Honor or battle citations whenever we qualified a member of Santa Fe in submarines. We would make announcements when passing sunken submarines. Back in Pearl Harbor, we visited the USS Bowfin Submarine Museum and called it officer training. I was worried that the crew would think some of these things tacky, but that wasn't the case. It helped provide organizational clarity into what we were about, the why for our service. Use your legacy for inspiration is a mechanism for clarity. Many organizations have inspiring early starts and somehow lose their way at some point. I urge you to tap into the sense of purpose and urgency that developed during those early days or during some crisis. The trick is to find real ways to keep those alive as the organization grows. One of the easiest is simply to talk about them, embed them into your guiding principles, and use those words in efficiency reports and personnel awards. In the submarine force, we had an obvious, unselfish, and rich legacy of service to the country, but we were almost embarrassed to talk about it. I'm not espousing an unthinking, kill bad guys culture, but that wasn't what happened. We just needed to resurrect the true legacy of our predecessors. Later, Rear Admiral Al Konecny invited me to Washington, D.C. to represent the Pacific Submarine Force at a large convention with the Department of Defense and submarine industry leaders. A significant number of retired admirals were in the audience. I decided to use this theme and titled the speech, "The Spirit is Alive." I simply talked about how the young sailors in today's Navy understood and appreciated what had happened before us, and in our way, we were doing our best to be true to that legacy. It was a great success and brought the crowd to a standing ovation that lasted a long time. Questions to consider. What is the legacy of your organization? How does that legacy shed light on your organization's purpose? What kind of actions can you take to bring this legacy alive for individuals in your organization? Chapter 23, Leadership at Every Level. Do your guiding principles help people in your organization make decisions? We figured out a way to do just that. 1998. A year before taking command of Santa Fe, Newport, Rhode Island, Command Leadership School. Command Leadership School have been a welcome two-week sabbatical during the year-long prospective commanding officer training. There were readings, discussions, and a couple of exercises. One of the exercises had been for everyone to write the guiding principles for their command to implement upon their arrival. I turned in a blank piece of paper. "Are you aware you turned in a blank sheet?" "Yes, sir, I am." "Well, don't you think that you, as the commander, have an obligation to create a vision for your command?" It was more of a statement than a question. "No, I feel that my job as the commander is to tap into the existing energy of the command, discover the strengths, and remove barriers to further progress." The class supervisor looked at me as if I had three heads, but I knew he wasn't going to fail me. When I first got to Santa Fe, I sent out a survey asking the officers and chiefs what they thought the strengths of the command were and what our guiding principles should be. We then had a couple of meetings to select the few we wanted to keep. Constraint, they all had to fit on one page. And what they meant. We were so busy, however, getting the ship out for the first underway and inspection, and then the repair period, we hadn't done much other than collect the initial inputs. Now, on deployment, we had the time to finish the job defining our guiding principles. The chiefs gathered in the wardroom one evening, and the officers the next. I wanted to make the guiding principles real, not something that just hung on the wall somewhere. When thinking about the principles and their utility, I used this question. If I were a crew member and faced with deciding between two different courses of actions, would these principles provide me with the right criteria against which to select the appropriate course of action? The guiding principles needed to do just that, provide guidance on decisions. USS Santa Fe Guiding Principles, Initiative. Initiative means we take action without direction from above to improve our knowledge of submariners, prepare the command for its missions, and come up with solutions to problems. With each member of the command taking initiative, the leverage is immense. Initiative has been a hallmark of the American fighting man and a key reason for our success. Initiative places an obligation on the chain of command not to stifle initiative in subordinates. Innovation. Innovation means looking at new ways of doing the same thing. It also means knowing which areas are above the waterline and appropriate to innovation, having the courage to change, and tolerating failures. Intimate technical knowledge. Modern submarines are extremely complex. Intimate technical knowledge means that each of us is responsible for learning our area of responsibility. We make decisions based on technical reasons, not hope. We understand the details of our watch stations and the interrelationship of systems. We diligently study. Courage. Courage means we choose to do the right thing, even if it may be uncomfortable. It means not just doing or saying what subordinates, peers, or superiors want to see or hear. It means admitting mistakes, even if ugly. Commitment. Commitment means we are present when we come to work. We give it our best. We choose to be here. Continuous improvement. Continuous improvement is how we get better. We continually seek ways to learn from processes and improve them and ourselves. The chain of command has the obligation to develop and institute mechanisms, such as conducting debriefs, to achieve continuous improvement. Integrity. Integrity means we tell the truth to each other and to ourselves. It means we have a grounded base of reality and see things as they are, not as we want them to be. Integrity means we participate fully in debriefs, allowing improvements to be based on facts. Empowerment. We encourage those below us to take action and support them if they make mistakes. We employ stewardship delegation, explaining what we want accomplished and allow flexibility in how it is accomplished. Teamwork. Submariners have traditionally worked as a team because a mistake by one person can mean disaster for all. We work as a team, not undercutting each other. The chain of command is obligated to implement mechanisms that encourage and reward teamwork. We back each other up in a positive way. Openness. We exercise participative openness, freedom to speak one's mind. Additionally, we exercise reflective openness, which leads to looking inward. We challenge our own thinking. We avoid the trap of listening to refute. Timeliness. Timeliness means we do things on time, start work on time, qualify on time, are ready to start evolutions and drills on time, and get to rendezvous points on time. Timeliness also recognizes that accomplishing most things faster is better, and that working to reduce inherent delays and time lags result in a more effective organization. Leadership at every level. Mechanism. Use guiding principles for decision criteria. Leaders like to hang a list of guiding principles on office walls for display, but often those principles don't become part of the fabric of the organization. Not on Santa Fe. We did several things to reinforce these principles and make them real to the crew. For example, when we wrote awards or evaluations, we tried to couch behaviors in the language of these principles. Petty Officer M exhibited courage and openness when reporting. My own behavior frequently needed adjustment when it was tested against the guiding principles. For example, I might initially attempt to dismiss a sailor who had a suggestion for a new way of doing business without listening to his suggestion. I might be expecting openness from the sailors, but at the same time responding to reports of mistakes with short-tempered irritation rather than reflective curiosity. When the guiding principles were helping me, they were helping others. Guiding principles have to accurately represent the principles of the real organization, not the imagined organization. Falseness in what the organization is about results in problems. Since these are a set of criteria that employees will use when they make decisions, decisions won't be aligned to the organization's goals. I've seen this, for example, in an organization that talked about safety first, but whose real interests were in profits and accepting degradations in safety if they were deemed reasonable. After all, the safest thing to do is shut down and send everyone home. But not acknowledging that they would be balancing safety with profits resulted in miscommunication, lack of credibility because everyone knew the truth, and unaligned decisions. Use guiding principles for decision criteria is a mechanism for clarity. Most of you have organizational principles. Go out and ask the first three people you see what they are. I was at one organization that proudly displayed its motto in Latin. I asked everyone I saw what it meant. The only person who knew was the CEO. That's not good. Questions to consider. How can you simplify your guiding principles so that everyone in your organization understands them? How will you communicate your principles to others? Are your guiding principles referenced in evaluations and performance awards? Are your guiding principles useful to employees as decision-making criteria? Do your guiding principles serve as decision-making criteria for your people? Do you know your own guiding principles? Do others know them?